Okay, thank you, Antoine. Well, it's very nice to be here, as always. I first came to the ITP in 1980 when I was a coordinator of one of the coordinators of a program on valence fluctuations in solids. And that's where I met my current colleague, Jorge Hirsch, when he and I were 22 years younger. Remember that? We look sort of the same, but. Okay, so what I want to do is, let's see, I guess that's not focused too well. How do I do this? Oh, I see, okay. This is a modern one. Okay, so I'd like to talk about heavy fermion superconductivity in the filled scudderite compound praseodymium osmium 4 antimony 12. It's kind of a strange compound. I'll tell you more about this. So in this talk, I'd like to first talk about the filled scudderites in general, the materials, their structure, the kinds of strongly correlated electron phenomena that they display besides heavy fermion superconductivity in this compound, and then present the evidence for heavy fermion superconductivity in praseodymium osmium antimonide. Say a little bit about what we know at this point about the nature of the superconducting state, possible origins of the heavy fermion state, and also evidence for a phase transition in a normal state at high magnetic fields that may have something to do with the superconductivity in this material. This work's been going on for, I don't know, a year and a half or more, and so we have a lot of collaborators, and I'm not going to name every one of them, but our group at San Diego, consisting of a postdoc and several students, and then at NIST, Jeff Lin and his student Matt Woodward have done some inelastic neutron scattering measurements. We've gotten some theoretical help from Daniel Cox and his collaborators at UC Davis. And Doug McLaughlin and a whole group of people at UC Riverside, Simon Fraser, Los Alamos, and Cal State University in Los Angeles have done some MIOSR measurements that have helped probe the superconducting state. We've done specific heat work with Hilbert von Lohneisen and his group in Karlsruhe. And we've worked with Frank Staglich and his group for thermal expansion and some other support from photo emission from colleagues in Poland, and also some thermoelectric power and crystallography work with some colleagues in Vienna. So let me say a little bit about the filled scudderites, and I'll show you some examples of strongly correlated electron behavior in some of the others. But the filled scudderites have this formula MT4X12, and this M ion can be an alkaline earth. It can be a lanthanide, such as these light lanthanides and ytterbium. And now, in the meantime, actually, people have made these by high-pressure synthesis, and now the whole rare earth series can be made. And also, M can be an actinide like thorium or uranium, and probably other actinides that we can't work on. And T is the transition metal iron, ruthenium, or osmium, and X is a nitrogen, phosphorus, arsenic, or antimony. So these things have a variety of interesting strongly correlated electron ground states and phenomena. They exhibit superconductivity, ferromagnetism, small hybridization gap semiconductivity, or in more modern terminology, people refer to this as Kondo insulator behavior, intermediate valence and heavy fermion behavior, metal insulator transitions, non-fermi liquid behavior, and now we found this evidence for heavy fermion superconductivity in this compound. And they're also of great interest because of their potential for thermoelectric applications, which is a whole another story. Here's the structure of these materials. The filled scudderites, which I'm talking about today, are derived from the binary scudderites, which have this formula TX3, where T now is a different set of transition elements, cobalt, rhodium, or iridium, and X is, again, phosphorus, arsenic, or antimony. And the prototype compound, cobalt triarsenide, was discovered in mineral form in Skutterud, Norway, and that's where the name comes from. And the M cations form a BCC sublattice, so in our case, these will be praseodymium ions. The T cations form a simple cubic sublattice. In this case, these will be the osmium atoms. And then the X ions form distorted corner sharing octahedra, which are centered by the T-cat ion. So that's shown here. So in that case, these would be the antimony atoms. And this has a cubic structure that was first worked out by Yechko and Brown in 1977. In case you're curious, this is what they look like in real space. And these are a bunch of little crystals that are embedded in the flux. They're grown in an antimony flux. And these are a bunch of little crystals you can see here. And they have to be etched out. And then this is one of them that's been separated. And this is a millimeter right here. So they're very small. And they're, you know, pretty challenging to work on if you're trying to do transport measurements. But you can do it. And also, it's difficult to do neutron scattering on such little crystals. So we're always trying to grow bigger ones. Okay, let me just show you some examples of the behavior of some of the other scudderdites, and then I'll talk about praseodymium osmium antimonide. Here are two examples of hybridization gap semiconductors, cerium iron phosphide and uranium iron phosphide, which we studied back in the mid-80s. And cerium iron phosphide is a paramagnetic semiconductor. Cerium has an intermediate valence. And if you pick a particular temperature range, you can, you know, there is activated behavior over that temperature range. And you can just, you know, estimate a gap. And if you do that between 85 Kelvin and 140 Kelvin, you get something like 130 millivolts. But, you know, I'm not trying to tell you that's the energy gap. It's just an estimate of what it could be based upon this rather complicated looking resistivity, but it certainly exhibits semiconducting behavior. Uranium iron phosphide has a smaller gap over that temperature range of 17 millielectron volts. It's also interesting because it orders ferromagnetically at 3.5 Kelvin, and so I think that's an interesting material to, you know, to work on, you know, for that reason, as well as the semiconducting behavior that it shows. If you look at the series of...
Are they always insulating?
Or no. Those are just the two insulators that we've studied. So now I'll come to some metals. And so I'm just trying to, you know, give you examples of the various kinds of strongly correlated phenomena that have been found and not really studied in very much detail. So this is a plot of the lattice parameter versus rare earth or M ion in the M iron antimonide compounds. And here, if you look at the lattice parameter here, you see it decreases within, as you go towards the heavier rare earths. That's the well-known lanthanide contraction. And if you look at cerium, you can see that cerium lies close to that curve, so it's very close to being trivalent. Ytterbium, on the other hand, is close to being divalent. And ytterbium is of interest because it's the F-hole analog of cerium. Ytterbium in the trivalent state having one F-hole, and cerium in that state having one F-electron. And it turns out that these two compounds display moderately heavy electron behavior. The effective mass of the cerium compound is about 80 times the electron mass, and for ytterbium it's about 25. So you find examples of moderately heavy electron behavior in these compounds. And to show you what happens for ytterbium iron antimonide, here is the resistivity, normalized resistivity, plotted versus temperature. And you see it exhibits typical heavy fermion behavior, although it's not as pronounced as in other materials like uranium beryllium 13, for example. But it does have a lot of scattering at high temperatures. And then as you enter this highly correlated Fermi liquid ground state, it drops off rather rapidly. And you can estimate a characteristic temperature of about 50 Kelvin. The susceptibility is reasonably temperature dependent at low temperatures. This tail right here is believed to be due to magnetic impurities, which you can saturate in a high magnetic field and then remove that contribution. So we think the real susceptibility looks like this. So, and also if you look at the ratio of the susceptibility and the electronic specific heat coefficient, the Wilson-Sommerfeld ratio, it's close to unity, indicating that you're really dealing with a heavy electron material. Yeah. Well, this is the, yeah, we believe this is due to magnetic impurities, other impurities, you know, like gadolinium or...
How can you know how to...
What you can do is that if these saturate according to a Brillouin function, which is a function of mu H over K Boltzmann times the temperature, then by going to low temperatures and high fields, you can saturate the magnetization, and then from the value of the saturated magnetization, estimate the amount of, or the Curie constant, and then you can simply subtract that from the...
And does it vary from sample to sample?
Yes, yeah. And this is a common thing you encounter in, you know, rare earth or actinide-based materials. You often have to correct for impurities. And we have other examples where this tail is nearly so large.
So you simply subtract the Brillouin function?
In essence, yeah.
And that includes, that depends on the concentration and on two or three parameters, right?
Well, you only have to remove the Brillouin function itself. I mean, it'll correspond to a certain magnetization or magnetic moment. And then you can, you don't even have to assume that that is associated with anything. You just take that magnetization and subtract it, and then the linear susceptibility that's left you attribute to the, you know, to the compound itself. So I'm sorry I have such a complicated example, but okay. Then if you look at C over T versus T squared, then this intercept, you know, is presumably close to what gamma is. And so it's of the order of 100 millijoules per mole Kelvin squared, or perhaps larger. Again, we don't know exactly how to deal with this little upturn. So to really, you know, understand this in more detail, you have to make material that's more pure and work hard to do a better job. But that's polycrystalline material. That was the first time anybody had made a scudderidite with a rare earth heavier than europium. So that in itself was an accomplishment, but one has to go back and work harder to get more detailed information. So here's an example from Takeda and Ishikawa in Japan on cerium, ruthenium, and antimonide. And so here's 1 over chi versus temperature. You see at high temperatures you have local moment behavior, but the susceptibility, this is 1 over chi, so the susceptibility goes through a peak, and then you have a little tail here, which in this case appears to be intrinsic. And then if you look at the resistivity, you see a lot of scattering at high temperatures. Again, it seems to drop off as you enter into some highly correlated ground state. But in this case, the resistivity doesn't behave as T squared as it would for a Fermi liquid, but it seems to be satisfied better, or described better, by T to the 1.6 power. So it appears to be a non-Fermi liquid-like situation that's observed in many rare earth and actinide compounds. And if you look at the specific heat divided by temperature versus temperature, you see a portion here that is consistent with the logarithmic divergence, or you can describe it by a weak power law. And then at low temperatures, it even increases faster. And nobody really understands why, but this is something that's seen in a number of non-Fermi liquid-like materials. And then here's some measurements from our own laboratory. If you look at that little tail in the susceptibility, you can describe that by a power law with an exponent of minus 0.35. And again, that's characteristic of many non-Fermi liquid type materials. We've done some work with our colleague Dmitry Basov, who's done some infrared absorption measurements, or reflectance measurements. And what's shown here is the conductivity versus frequency. And at high temperatures, you get Drude-like behavior. This is due to interband transitions, so I'm told. And then as you lower the temperature, you see the conductivity increases, and this Drude part narrows. And then at a certain temperature, say in the neighborhood of, I don't know, below 100 Kelvin, you get a feature here that's associated with an energy gap or pseudo gap. And I guess you could schematically try to understand this on the basis of this hybridization model that has been studied by many people and first introduced by Mott in 1970, where you would start out with a narrow F level, or an F level or a narrow F band, and then this parabolic conduction band. And then as they hybridize, they form these two bands right here. And so in this case, it would appear that the Fermi level would be not in the gap like it would be for the case of the cerium and uranium iron phosphide compounds I mentioned earlier, but say somewhere in here. And so you'd have a metal, and you'd have a gap here, and perhaps that's the origin of this feature right here. And if you look at such measurements in other heavy fermion compounds, then here are data for ytterbium iron antimonide, and here's data for cerium ruthenium antimonide. This is the one that I showed you a moment ago that has this non-fermion liquid-like characteristics. And then some other heavy fermion compounds that do not order magnetically, then there's an interesting correlation, so it appears, between this energy gap divided by this characteristic temperature T star squared and the effective mass divided by the band mass. These things all seem to lie on this curve, and the blue points here correspond to other heavy fermion compounds that order magnetically, so perhaps the magnetism in some way also contributes to the effective mass and causes these to lie away from this line. But anyway, it's suggestive, and it's not inconsistent with some of the predictions that have been made by a number of models, such as the one by Andy Millis in 1987, where it's predicted that the effective mass divided by the band mass should be proportional to the energy gap divided by this characteristic temperature T star squared. So it seems to be consistent. Yes?
How do you get T star to mean this
bar? T star is deduced from the resistivity. So the example I showed you was this one here for ytterbium iron antimonide. So T star would be, say, a temperature like the inflection point of this curve or something like that. But again, it's just an estimate. I mean, it's not a very precise number.
And delta? But how is it extracted?
A delta is extracted from this feature in the infrared spectrum, where it would be the onset of conductivity, so it would be this frequency here.
But some heavy fermions do not have that. They just have to do the peak and very flat and don't have that minima.
Yeah.
So I guess for those, one cannot do this correlation?
Well, I think this is the beginning of something that needs to be looked into, because there are a number of them that do have energy gaps that you can see.
Right.
But of course, it also depends upon what your experimental window, and I'm not really an expert to say whether or not that's the reason it hasn't been seen in other heavy fermion compounds, but it does seem to be interesting that you have this correlation, and there seems to be a theoretical basis for it, but I don't know how to address the...
Another,
yes.
An M star is from specific
heat? M star can be extracted from the optical conductivity, and it's consistent with specific heat.
Is there any evidence that these ones are closer to the local moment limit as opposed to mid-band?
Well, I mean, the ytterbium compound is quite in the mixed valent region. The cerium one actually is nearly trivalent. So I don't know quite how that in itself as a single feature would be relevant, but
so one might expect that this pseudo gap is more visible as you get closer to the local.
Yes. Yeah. Right. I mean, if the energy scale was very large, then you might simply not see it, and it'd be outside the range. But anyway, it's something I think is very interesting, and is one of the things that these scudderidites have given rise to. Okay, so let me now turn to the issue that I wanted to discuss. So this is this compound, praseodymium osmium antimonide, and I want to present some evidence for heavy fermion behavior in this compound. So this is a plot of specific heat divided by temperature versus temperature, and these are the experimental data. And what you see here is what appears to be a pronounced Schottky anomaly, and then superimposed on that is a jump due to the superconductivity. And this line here is a fit of an electronic contribution plus a lattice contribution plus a Schottky anomaly corresponding to a doublet ground state and a triplet excited state that's low-lying at about 7 Kelvin. And I've identified these as gamma 3 and gamma 5 for reasons that I'll come back to in a while, but just think of them as doublets and triplets for the moment. And you can see that these describe the data quite well. Now if you take the, okay, and if you do that, then the gamma turns out to be very large, about 600 millijoules per mole Kelvin squared. The Debye temperature is about 200 Kelvin. And then the Schottky anomaly, again, is between a doublet ground state and a triplet excited state, and that's the splitting. Okay, so it appears that you have a heavy fermion situation. Now if you look at the jump due to the superconductivity, that's shown in more detail in the upper inset. And there, if you take the ratio of this jump after you make this entropy conserving construction, and we would call TC 1.77 Kelvin according to this construction, then if you take the ratio of delta C over TC, it's about 600 millijoules per mole Kelvin squared. And if you just take the BCS result as just a zeroth order approximation and solve for gamma, you get a gamma of 440 millijoules per mole Kelvin squared. So this, I think, you know, supports the analysis from which this large gamma came from the normal state behavior. Another thing that I'll come back to is that these measurements were made right at the beginning of our work on this, where we took a lot of single crystals, and in order to get enough mass, we crushed them and pressed them into a pellet, and that gave rise to this specific heat jump, which is rather broad. If you look at it carefully, it looks like it might actually consist of two jumps, and in all the single crystals we've looked at, a single crystal or a collection of single crystals without straining them like we did in this first experiment, then we see that this is resolved into what appears to be two jumps, suggesting that perhaps you have two distinct superconducting phases. So that would be like uranium platinum 3 or uranium beryllium 13 with thorium substitutions. Okay, now if you look at the upper critical field, which you can deduce from the resistivity versus temperature measured in various fields, in our case up to 30 kiloersteds, then you can extract the TCs, and these are the blue points shown here, and the zero temperature critical field is about 22 kiloersteds. And if you take this initial slope, neglecting this little positive curvature right near TC, it's about 19 kiloersteds per Kelvin, and it's rather large. And if you take this initial slope, you can estimate the orbital critical field, which turns out to be about 24 kiloersteds. And then from the orbital critical field and the flux quantum, you can deduce the superconducting coherence length, which is about 100 angstroms. And then from that, you can estimate the Fermi velocity. And then if you make a simple free electron estimation of the Fermi wave vector, you can deduce the effective mass. And that turns out to be about 50 times the electron mass. And then if you calculate gamma, you get 350 millijoules per mole Kelvin squared. Okay. Now, all of these numbers, I don't care about how accurate they are. What I care about is that they're all big, and they're all of the order of 300 or 400 times, or maybe even 600 times, 600 millijoules per mole Kelvin squared, and consistent with a large effective mass, say in the neighborhood of 50 or perhaps even larger times the electron mass.
Is there any orientational dependence? What's the direction of this relative to the crystal?
Oh, this is along the 100 axis. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But does it matter? I mean, how?
No, it's cubic, and it's not.
Oh, it's cubic.
Yeah.
Cubic.
Yeah. Right. Okay. No. Okay, and there is other support for this that came from recent measurements from other groups. The Hausmann-Alfen experiments, on the basis of these made by Sugawara and co-workers, they conclude that the effective mass of praseodymium osmium for antimony 12 is about 6 times the effective mass of the lanthanum compound. It turns out that the electronic structures are very similar. The what they see in the Hausmann-Alfen is very similar. From estimates of the mass for the lanthanum compound, they conclude that the gamma of the praseodymium compound is about 150 millijoules per mole Kelvin squared for those orbits that they can access. And then from antimony NQR measurements, again, through some arguments, they conclude that the density of states of the praseodymium compound is about 5.2 times that of the lanthanum compound. And from this result, they can estimate that the gamma is about 300 millijoules per mole Kelvin squared. So there's other evidence that supports the conclusion that we reached from the measurements that I showed you. Okay, now what about the superconductivity? Is it unconventional, like it appears to be in most heavy fermion compounds? Here's the specific heat after you subtracted the lattice term and the Schottky anomaly. So this then is the electronic specific heat plotted versus temperature on a log-log plot. And you can describe these data by a power law with an exponent of 2.5, although I don't know how seriously you can take this because it's pretty close to TC, and we haven't been able to go to really low temperatures to study this because one has to subtract off an enormous nuclear Schottky anomaly, and we don't know how to do that accurately. So all I can say is, on the basis of these data, it's suggestive that you could have nodes in the gap. And power law behavior that you find for most heavy fermion superconductors ranges, this exponent ranges between 2 and 3, and you would expect for line nodes 2, and for point nodes 3. So it's just suggestive. Well, that's an interesting thing. I mean, there are materials where people think there are nodes that are points and lines, so. Although I don't know if they'd give you that exponent. So I don't want to say that exponent shouldn't be taken too seriously for reasons that I'll come to in a moment. Okay, and again, here's C over T versus T. And this is close to TC, again showing you the structure. And by making entropy conserving constructions, as shown by these red curves, you can find two superconducting critical temperatures, or it would appear to be the case. And so it's possible then that those are due to two distinct superconducting phases. If you look at the critical field curve measured in more detail than the previous data, you don't see any indication of any structure in this critical field curve. And so from these data and from specific heat measurements made in the field, this structure seems to move along with the lower TC seems to move along with the upper TC, if indeed that's what they represent. And so we really don't know whether this is two distinct superconducting phases or whether it's due to some sort of inhomogeneity in these crystals. But it's curious that this inhomogeneity is the same in all crystals. They all have the same structure measured by us or our collaborators. So, and here it is in the thermal expansion measured in Dresden. So here's the volume thermal expansion versus temperature. And here you see the near TC. In the inset, you see this structure indicative of these two transitions. And from some thermodynamic relationships, you can deduce the pressure dependence of the two superconducting phases that correspond to these two TCs, if that's what they are. And they're different, suggesting that perhaps that is indeed the case. But I think one really has to do more to find that out. And we're trying to do that. And here's how these features move in a magnetic field. So these are data from Karlsruhe. And here you see in the inset the double feature. So this is another set of measurements. And then in a magnetic field, this moves down. But the splitting seems to stay more or less the same. And then eventually, you can no longer resolve it anymore. So, and they get virtually the same results, a gamma in this case of 300 millijoules per mole Kelvin squared, and the splitting again is a 7 Kelvin. So this curve here is just this expression fitted to the data. And here's this enormous nuclear Schottky anomaly that we don't know quite how to deal with at this point.
What was the resistivity like of this compound?
Well, I'll come to that actually. I haven't shown you that yet. And it's not like what you would think. Probably. So I'll come to that shortly, because that's another one of the surprises. Okay, now Doug McLaughlin and his co-workers have done MuSR measurements in a field of 200 Oersteds, And what they find is that the MuSR relaxation rate versus temperature, these are the data right here, these can be described very well by, from this, let me just put it this way, from this you can extract the penetration depth, and that's what's shown here in the inset. So this is penetration depth versus temperature. And this curve here is based upon the BCS relationship, which is shown here. And from this, they find that the energy gap divided by TC is equal to 2.1. The BCS value is 1.76. And so from this, you would infer that you have an isotropic energy gap. And so that would suggest that this is either an S-wave superconductor or perhaps a Baleen-Werthermer type P-wave superconductor or something with an isotropic gap. And if you look at nuclear quadrupole resonance measurements, this is done by Kotagawa and co-workers, then this is 1 over T1 versus temperature. And for reference, here's lanthanum osmium antimonide. This is a conventional BCS superconductor. You see a coherence peak here, and then 1 over T1 behaves exponentially with a energy gap to TC ratio of 3.2, indicating weak coupling. But then when you look at the praseodymium compound, apart from the strange behavior in the normal state, there you don't see a coherence peak, which is consistent with what's observed in most other heavy fermion superconductors. But in this case, rather than seeing T-cube behavior, which virtually all heavy fermion superconductors exhibit, you see exponential behavior starting even above TC. And here the energy gap to TC ratio is 5.3, indicating some strong coupling effects for this particular material. So this again suggests that you have an isotropic gap, but it's not like an ordinary superconductor because you don't have this coherence peak, and this behavior even starts above TC, and they've actually conjectured that you might have some sort of pseudo gap. Lanthanum is, let's see, I think they think it's 0.7, and we find it to be around 1 degree, so let's say it's roughly 1 degree. So this is a coherence peak, the jump. Okay, and now the most recent data, I mean, that's sort of pointing towards an isotropic gap. And now here's some measurements of thermal conductivity in various magnetic fields, similar to what's been done for high TC superconductors to address the question of the symmetry of the superconducting order parameter. So here what they do is, this is work by Izawa and Matsuda and co-workers. Here, let's take a bar-shaped crystal like this. And so you're going to measure the thermal conductivity along this axis here, which is, say, 001. And then you apply a magnetic field, and you have a polar angle, which represents the orientation of the magnetic field with respect to this sample axis. And then, of course, you can rotate that in the plane, so you have this azimuthal angle, phi. So this will be the 100 direction and the 010 direction, 010 direction. And by doing this, you can look for angular dependence of the thermal conductivity and deduce from this where there could be nodes in the energy gap function. So let's see, this is kind of complicated, but here is the thermal conductivity divided by temperature versus temperature in zero field and in 2.5 Tesla where it's normal. So it shows you how you get a decrease of the thermal conductivity when it becomes superconducting with some peculiar structure here. And so here is a plot of this ratio versus temperature, again just showing how it drops off at TC. And then this is a plot of the thermal conductivity versus magnetic field at 0.4 Kelvin, showing how once you reach HC2, then you recover the normal state thermal conductivity. Okay, so what they do then is to first start out with the magnetic field in this basal plane. And this then represents the thermal conductivity versus angle. And so if you start out at lower fields, let's see now, this is so complicated, I'm getting confused. So this is at 0.52 Kelvin. And if you start out at lower fields, then so you'd be near TC in zero field, then they find that there's a a periodic behavior of the thermal conductivity, which has maxima at 0 degrees and 180 degrees, and then minima at minus 90 degrees and 90 degrees, as referred to this figure right here. Okay, and so this two-fold structure then, they think this represents two point nodes on the Fermi surface. And then when you go to higher fields, this actually develops a four-fold modulation. And they then think that this changes symmetry, and now you have point nodes, six-point nodes on the Fermi surface. Okay, that's the conclusion from this experiment. And so what's then shown here is if you now represent the thermal conductivity as some, say, some constant plus a two-fold and a four-fold contribution, and then you have these two coefficients, then as you increase the magnetic field, normalized to HC2, you first see the two-fold structure, and it, when it disappears, you get the four-fold modulation, and then it disappears when it becomes normal. And they then construct in phase diagram for magnetic field versus temperature, where they call this the A phase, and so this has 6 point nodes on the Fermi surface, and the B phase has 2 point nodes. And then there's a phase boundary here representing or dividing this phase diagram into these two superconducting phases with different order parameter symmetry. Now, how does this square with the previous measurements? I'm not sure, but I don't know what to say. But in any case, it's certainly interesting. And it doesn't appear that this phase boundary has anything to do with the double peak in the specific heat jump, or double structure, which moves along like this in this phase diagram. So they seem to be...
the magnetic field dependence along that line, that you have the double peak? There's no signature. You think there's a third boundary in this?
Yes, line? Right. That's right.
Which now, is not seen in this experiment.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, what they conjectured was that perhaps, you know, you have this double peak here, and this joins on to TC2, and this one joins on to TC1. But our experiments have indicated that the TC2 actually moves along this way from the specific heat feature. So this appears to be something different, something in addition. And again, you know, we don't really know that the double, that the structure in the jump near TC is actually due to two distinct superconducting phases, but it's always the same. And so it just seems unlikely that every single sample we would make would have the same distribution of, you know, concentration gradients. So, okay, so that's where the superconductivity stands at the moment. Let me now return to the normal state. Let's see, how much time do I have? Okay, so I'm sure I'll finish before that. Okay, so now let's go back to the normal state. And here is magnetic susceptibility versus temperature. So at high temperatures, you see it's strongly temperature dependent, and you can even represent it with a Curie-Weiss law with a moment of about 3 Bohr magnetons and a negative Curie-Weiss temperature of 16 Kelvin. But it goes through a peak and then approaches a finite value towards zero temperature, indicating that it has a non-magnetic ground state. And also you can see in this upper inset that you get diamagnetism when it becomes superconducting, as you would expect at 1.85 Kelvin. So we wanted to understand this susceptibility, and if you look at it in more detail, as shown in this inset right here, then in order to describe it, what we did is we just assumed that to zeroth order approximation that we were dealing with free praseodymium ions in a cubic crystal electric field, and we used a Lee-Liesk and Wolf theory for crystal field effects for a cubic crystal field. And in the cubic crystal field, the praseodymium J equal 4 ninefold degenerate Hund's rule multiplet will split up into a gamma 1 singlet and a gamma 3 doublet, that a non-magnetic doublet that carries an electric quadrupole moment, and then gamma 4 and gamma 5 triplets. And so we found that there were two situations that best described the data, one corresponding to a gamma 1 singlet ground state, a gamma 5 and gamma 4 excited states, and then the gamma 3 here, or another one where gamma 3 was down here and gamma 1 was up here, but gamma 4 and gamma 5 retained their same relative position in this energy level scheme. Okay, so the blue curve then represents the assumption of a gamma 1 ground state, the red curve that of a gamma 3 ground state, and that corresponds to these splittings shown here. And what we concluded from this is that the gamma 3 ground state seemed to describe the data better, and so we then concluded that the gamma 3 was the ground state. Okay, and this is also, it's a doublet. This is also consistent with the specific heat that I showed you earlier. Now, both of these energy level schemes have low-lying gamma 5 triplets that are, say, about 10 Kelvin above the ground state. So you have this low-lying excited state. Okay. All right, so the conclusion then was that gamma 3 was the ground state. And so we then worked with Jeff Lynn to do some neutron scattering. And the neutron scattering data are consistent with this and also consistent with the same energy level scheme. And so what's shown here are inelastic spectra taken by Matt Woodward and Jeff Lynn. And they find peaks in the inelastic neutron scattering intensity at 8.2 Kelvin. That's from these data here. And 134 Kelvin. That's from these data here. And that then corresponds to this energy level scheme, which is virtually identical to the one that we inferred from the susceptibility. Okay. I mean, certainly within experimental error. All right, so our conclusion is that, but it's not a proof, is that it looks like gamma 3 is the ground state. And now let's go to the resistivity that you were asking about. So here's electrical resistivity. It's not really typical of a heavy fermion compound, at least the ones that we know, that where the heavy fermion state is generated or believed to be generated by magnetic interaction. So a typical heavy fermion compound has a resistivity versus temperature that schematically looks like this. It often increases as you lower the temperature due to some Kondo-like scattering. It goes through a peak and then drops off dramatically as you enter some highly correlated heavy fermion liquid ground state. And what we find for this heavy fermion material is something that looks very uninteresting and like a typical metal. You do see some negative curvature here, and there are some interesting features. For example, the resistivity can be described by a T-squared relationship between about 8 Kelvin and I think 35 Kelvin, but the coefficient here is a few orders of magnitude smaller than what you'd expect from the for a typical heavy fermion compound, where this coefficient, according to this empirical work of Kadowaki and Woods, should be given by this expression here. It's proportional to gamma squared, and for a gamma, say, of 350 millijoules per mole Kelvin squared, it ought to be in the neighborhood of 1 microohm centimeter per Kelvin squared. And here you see it's 0.009. Okay, so it's way too small. Now, there may be a reason for this. If you look at lower temperatures, you see that the resistivity decreases by 50% or so before it drops to zero when it becomes superconducting. And I think this is easy to understand, because if you have charge or spin-dependent scattering of electrons from this low-lying excited state, as you lower the temperature, this excited state depopulates over a temperature scale consistent with these variations, and that scattering then decreases, and then of course it eventually becomes superconducting. So I think that's consistent with this low-lying excited state that we see in these other measurements, and it could be that this behavior here masks some T-squared behavior that would like to be there at lower temperatures that would then have a coefficient that would be consistent with this large value. That's one possibility. Now, What doesn't really support that possibility is if you take this compound, praseodymium indium silver 2, this is the first compound with a gamma 3 ground state where heavy fermion behavior was seen, although this one's not superconducting. Here, this has a gamma of about 7 millijoules per mole Kelvin squared. It's enormous, and its resistivity is very uninteresting looking and not very much different than what you see here. Okay, it does not, by the way, have a low-lying excited state, so you don't see this roll-off at low temperatures.
Have the crystal field splittings been seen in neutron scattering in any of these praseodymium compounds?
Well, in the one I just showed you, those inelastic peaks, those two peaks.
Right.
And in this one, I believe there's a lot of neutron scattering data for that.
And they agree with your...
Yeah, in our case, it agrees. Now, again, it's not. We haven't proven it yet. I think we have to do a better job of the inelastic scattering. You know, to do it in a field and, you know, and Zeeman split the energy levels and you know, really prove that gamma 3 is a ground state. That has not been done. But there's evidence, you know, I've presented evidence for it. There's other evidence from acoustic attenuation. But, you know, not everybody agrees that that's the ground state. So that remains a puzzle. It turns out in high fields, you can describe the data, you know, not very well, but well enough over a limited temperature range. So this is resistivity versus T squared in very high fields. Say 30 kiloaristeds to 80 kiloaristeds. Here you actually see evidence for a transition into another ordered phase. And once you're in that phase, these data, you know, are, you know, can be described by T squared, and then you do get coefficients of the magnitude that you would expect for a heavy fermion compound. But these data are actually better described by a power law where the exponent is, you know, 3.2 or something like that. So I don't know. Okay, so that now brings me to the, let me skip some things here. See, we've also done nonlinear susceptibility measurements trying to prove that the ground state's gamma 3, and that's kind of a long story that's not, we haven't reached a convincing conclusion, so I'm going to skip that. Let me now just turn to one last issue, and that's what happens in high fields. So here are resistivity versus temperature measurements, similar to what I showed you earlier. So in lower fields, you see the superconducting transitions. So as you increase the field, the transition moves to lower temperatures. Eventually, the superconductivity is suppressed. And then when you go to higher fields, at about 4.5 Tesla and above, you see features, and I also showed that on the previous view graph, that suggests that you're going into some ordered state in high fields. Okay, so the little kinks that develop here. And if you take and plot the derivative of the resistivity with respect to temperature versus temperature, you can see this inflection point here. It kind of sharpens up in higher fields. You also see another inflection point that's associated with the roll-off of the resistivity due to this low-lying crystalline electric field level. And that actually decreases in temperature in higher fields. Again, you have to look at that for a while to convince yourself of that, but trust me on that. So it looks like you're going into some ordered phase, and then you can see this also in the specific heat. So this is specific heat versus temperature. These are data from Karlsruhe. And so in low fields, you see the Schottky anomaly. Or say zero field, you see the Schottky anomaly and the jump due to the superconductivity. As you increase the field, the Schottky anomaly gets suppressed, the superconducting transition gets suppressed, and then at 4.5 Tesla, you see the development of, it's somewhere in there, this feature here that's appears to be due to the formation of some ordered phase, and this thing gets stronger and stronger as you increase the field, as you can see here, okay? And so that's what you see in the specific heat that identifies the onset of this phase. And then in thermal expansion, you can also see this. So, sorry for this view graph, not so good. But anyway, so these features here in high fields represent the entrance into this high field phase. And from that, we've constructed this lower part of the phase boundary right here. And then lately we've been making more measurements to higher fields using a variety of techniques. And so here are measurements in fields between 10 Tesla and 18 Tesla. And so now you see that, you can remember the other curves I showed you, they were increasing in magnitude as you increase the field up to 10 Tesla. And now this thing is decreasing in magnitude in higher fields. And you can see again the sharp part indicating this entrance into this high field phase. What's shown here is resistance versus field at various fixed temperatures. And at the lowest field, you see this feature as you go into the ordered phase, presumably ordered phase, and then you go through this dome-shaped structure, and then you come out of it over here. And so this dome shape is kind of interesting, because if this is a more ordered phase, and the resistivity is decreasing like this, why do you get this, why is this riding on this background dome? We don't know that. And also you can see this in magnetization, which I won't show you. But from all that, you can then construct the following phase diagram that is being refined as we speak. But it now looks something like this. So here's magnetic field versus temperature. Here's the superconducting phase down here. And then this represents a measure of the splitting between the lowest energy Zeeman level of the triplet excited state and the highest energy Zeeman level of the doublet ground state, we believe. So it kind of goes like this. And it's decreasing in higher fields. And then you reach this region here where presumably you have some sort of ordered phase here, which we presume is due to either quadrupolar order or magnetic order. We've looked with neutrons just doing diffraction and saw nothing through here. So it doesn't seem to be any type of strong magnetic order. It could be quadrupolar order, which would be very difficult to see in the polycrystalline sample that we've investigated. So this needs to be sorted out. And then this also has a directional dependence. If you measure with the field along the 100 direction, the 110 direction, or the 111 direction, you get a set of boundaries here. So this thing actually has some anisotropy associated with it. And then from some work done with Roy Goodrich in high magnetic fields, he's trying to do the Hausmann-Alfvén measurements, he sees even other transitions at higher fields. So this whole thing seems to have a really rich and interesting phase diagram, and it's possible that, you know, there's some quantum critical point here that could have some relationship to the superconductivity, as you see, you know, or find in other heavy fermion superconductors. So anyway, this whole thing is evolving, and I'm afraid I've raised more questions than I've answered.
Do you have any intuition why magnetic field may stabilize the quadrupolar order?
Well, the charge distribution is sort of locked to the angular momentum, and so if you start, you know, applying magnetic fields, you move things around. So we have the orbitals, and you have magnetic moments and quadrupolar moments, and they're all coupled together.
The ground state has no moment.
Yeah, well, that's true. But remember that in a field, the doublet is splitting in Zeeman levels like this, and then the triplet is splitting into these Zeeman levels, and they're crossing at about the same field where, you know, where this all happens. Now, I don't know what's happening, okay, let me just say that, and then let me say another thing. If you take praseodymium lead 3, that has an antiferroquadrupolar state that occurs in high fields. And so it has a phase diagram similar to what I showed you, but it's not superconducting. And its phase boundary looks kind of comes like this and then bends over and then intersects the axis here. So I think it's going to, you know, it's a complicated situation, and we don't even know that it's quadrupolar order, but that's my best guess at this point. Okay, so this is a figure from my graduate student who has a flair for the dramatic. So here are the known uranium-based heavy fermion superconductors, and then the cerium-based heavy fermion superconductors, and this appears to be the first example, I'm sorry, cerium, I should have said, of a praseodymium-based heavy fermion superconductor. And so I'm hoping that, you know, there are more of these things and we can study them some more if we can find any more of them. I have a summary here, but I think I probably don't have to go through it. Let me just say that to me, this is a very interesting finding. We certainly don't understand it. I think we're making progress. And it's possible that if you do have this quadrupolar ground state and this low-lying magnetic excited state, that these could be involved in the superconductivity. And so I guess my hope is that the superconductivity itself has a quadrupolar mechanism. That would be the most interesting. I mean, I can't change reality, but that, I would find that to be very interesting. And also, it appears to be it appears that the heavy fermion state itself, may be traceable to this quadrupolar ground state. So I think that's what I find interesting about this material, and hopefully others like it that we and other people will find in the future. So, thanks a lot.
You mentioned that concerning the superconducting state, both the praseodymium and the lanthanum compounds, both superconducting.
Yes.
Now, has it been established that the Fermi surfaces are the same with those two materials, or are they different? Or?
Well, they're very similar, but the masses are different.
All the differences they're having, the two transitions, they're all coming from the masses, not from any additional orbit or anything like that.
Well, as far as I know, the band structure very similar. Okay, the Fermi surfaces are very similar. Now, in the praseodymium case, of course, you have these internal degrees of freedom associated with this praseodymium F state, which, to first approximation is behaving very much like an ionic state, but it has to be hybridized with the conduction electron states. And so I think the real difference is this internal structure and the quadrupolar nature of this local state, localized state. I was going to say something, I forgot what it was.
But it's always difficult to account for all of the orbits in the astronomical experiments because you're missing.
You have to go to higher fields, lower temperatures.
That's right.
Yeah. But at least they've seen some of the extra mass, so I was happy about that. The thing I was going to say is that in many heavy fermion superconductors, the non-magnetic counterpart is not superconducting, or if it is superconducting, has a very low critical temperature. And the same thing happens here. This is superconducting at 1.85 Kelvin. Its lanthanum non-magnetic or non-quadrupolar counterpart is superconducting at 1 Kelvin. It turns out that there are other praseodymium superconductors amongst these scheduledites, but their critical temperatures are always smaller than the lanthanum counterparts. Now, this is not a proof of anything, but it's, kind of consistent with the lore of heavy fermion materials.
You mentioned uranium in the last slide, uranium or turning to silicon, which seems to have like quadrupolar order zero field. Maybe something ferromagnetic, but I think there are interpretations according to which is a parasitic effect, and the real order is
quadrupolar. Yeah.
Do you know if any of the other phenomenology of this compound looks similar?
Is like uranium, ruthenium, 2-silicon-2? We've studied uranium, ruthenium, 2-silicon-2 a lot. What we thought back in 1986 or 85, whenever it was, is that that one forms some sort of charge or spin density wave because the feature at the temperature at which it becomes antiferromagnetic is like a second order mean field BCS transition. And if you, for example, apply pressure, you move the nail temperature up and the superconducting critical temperature goes down. And we made estimates that in zero field that this spinner charge density wave that also coincided with the magnetic transition occupied about 40% of the Fermi surface and the superconductivity the rest. And so under pressure, we thought that the density wave, occupied more of the Fermi surface and superconductivity less as you applied pressure. Now, how does this fit in with the hidden order parameter and the fact that the magnetic moment starts out at a few hundredth of a Bohr magneton at zero pressure and then becomes, a fraction of a Bohr magneton under pressure? I don't know. So those kinds of characteristics seem rather different than what we're dealing with here. Thank you. Thank you for coming during the last week of the workshop.
So you're going to be around?
I'll be around today, sure.
Today.
Yeah.
Did you announce on Wednesday?